Until recently, people who'd experienced damage to their spinal cords had little hope that they'd ever walk, dress themselves, and in some cases, even breathe on their own again. After Christopher Reeve became paralyzed following an accident in 1995, he started a foundation to help develop better rehabilitation methods for people who had been paralyzed. And joining me now to talk about some promising developments that have come out of that work is his daughter, Alexandra Reeve Givens, an attorney and a member of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's board of directors. Also here is Dr. Steve Williams, the chairman of the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and director of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Neuro Recovery Network at the Boston Medical Center. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Alexandra, how old were you at the time of your father's accident?
I was 11, and my older brother Matthew was 15, and our younger brother Will was just 2, turning 3.
And were you completely aware of what had happened and the significance of it?
We were. Our family was very open about what was happening. I lived in England at the time. I grew up going back and forth. My father lived in the States. I was raised with my mother in England. And we flew over straight away, and we're in the emergency room down at UVA. They set up a wing for the family, and we were camped out there. He was there for about a month, and we were kept up to speed with what was going on.
Now, Steve, he shattered the first and second vertebrae. Would that automatically mean paralysis?
So when the vertebrae are shattered, there is often instability in the bony fragments, the bony canal that surrounds the cord. And with that instability, the cord is often torqued or pinched, and bleeding occurs into the cord. And the blood is very toxic to the nerve cells. So immediately as the nerve cells come in contact with the blood, they die, which results in the paralysis.
And would that mean automatically that it would be for the rest of his life or anyone who went through this kind of, had this kind of accident?
So spinal cord injuries are permanent. Occasionally, spinal cord injury patients can have natural recovery from spinal cord injury. It really is based on how much damage occurs at the time of the injury.
How much attention had the medical community focused on developing rehabilitations or even finding a cure for spinal cord injuries and paralysis before Christopher Reeve's injury? Alexandra, have you looked into that?
Well, there was certainly work being done. There were foundations out, private foundations that were funding medical research, and certainly it was a developing field of medicine. What Dad discovered, though, was that it, in some ways it was still considered a backwater. You know, it was a final sentence. The doctor came in, said, "You're paralyzed, that's it, period. Now go learn how to deal with it."
And your father said he considered suicide for a little while.
I think anybody, when they are faced with very serious news such as that, and particularly with the level of severity of his injury, who can blame them for, you know, stopping and taking stock? But he was quick to realize that we still wanted him around. You know, my brothers, my stepmother, our whole family needed him there and still wanted him as to lead our family and to be there for us. And so he soon turned his energies to focusing on medical developments and what could be done. And the time since then, there's been remarkable progress.
How long did he live?
He lived for 10 years after his injury.
Steve, isn't one of the areas being considered for helping in these kinds of cases stem cell research?
Yes, there is stem cell search. And in fact, the first stem cell trial for people with spinal cord injury, it will start this fall. And it's sponsored by a company called Geron. And the PhD doctor who is doing this trial is Dr. Hans Kerstedt at UC Irvine at the Reeve Irvine Institute.
So talking about the accident, the destruction of the first and second vertebrae, what would stem cells do to correct that situation?
So as I said, when the original injury occurs and the nerves that make up the spinal cord come in contact with the blood and they die, they cease to function. So the hope is that stem cells could somehow knit back the cord where the area of damage occurred. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a lot of research that needs to be done there, but we've really come quite far in the last 5 years, not as far as we would like, but hopefully with this upcoming trial we'll have greater information.
Did you have a chance to know Christopher Reed personally?
I had met Christopher once, and I knew Dana because Dana's sister had gone to medical school at Boston University.
How important is the advocacy of somebody that well-known to the field of medicine? Does it automatically mean that people pay more attention or more likely to try to help?
I absolutely think that did occur when Christopher was injured. He used his voice in an amazing way to really change the lives of potentially millions of people around the world. And I think his fame brought attention to his circumstances. And I think that he was very wise in challenging people and forming the foundation to proceed with research. And as Alexander said, there had been really some research, but not a lot of research till that time. And I think that his voice was a powerful voice that was a call for people to come together.
My guests are Dr. Steve Williams, the chairman of the Department of Rehabilitative Medicine?
Rehabilitation.
At Boston University School of Medicine, director of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Neuro Recovery Network at the Boston Medical Center, and Alexandra Reeve Givens, an attorney and member of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Board of Directors. And we are talking about new advances in treating spinal cord injuries. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Alexandra, listeners may not realize how active your father was before his accident. He sailed, he scuba dived, skied, windsurfed, cycled, mountain climbing, tennis, also learned to fly, to glide, to hang glide.
Oh, boy, Leonard, the list just begins with that. He was a very, very active person. Our whole family was and still is.
He couldn't fly, but I understand he did some of his stunts in the movies as well.
Yes, exactly. You're right. Flying came with the help of some wires, but the rest of the things he tried to do himself, and he could pilot a plane as well by the age of 26, which puts me to shame.
So it's only natural, I think, for him to focus on physical exercise as a way of dealing with his paralysis.
That's exactly right. And I think it was very important, not only for his mental well-being, but then the physical benefits of that were significant as well. And that's something that we're really beginning to learn over the course of the years. It's just the importance for people living with a spinal cord injury to stay fit, to keep doing rehabilitative work, to keep their circulation going. You know, all of these things that tend to fall by the wayside sometimes. It's one of the most severe difficulties that people with facing a spinal cord injury face is the problems with insurance companies with getting access to these treatments. A lot of times insurance companies will pay for treatments only for parts of your body that is still mobile. What's really, really important is to keep the other parts as well so that you keep up flexibility, maintain skin condition, and just stay in the best health possible.
And we've seen in some cases people wind up being able to do amazing things. You were on a panel that I moderated some time back, and Chuck Close, the painter, was there mm-hmm. as well. And he has continued his art career to the point where you can't tell the difference between the paintings pre his spinal cord injury and post spinal cord injury.
And that's really the incredible thing. Chuck's work is amazing, and he, like my father, was lucky in that he was able to keep on working after his injury, sure, you know, with adaptive technologies. But
your father directed films.
He did. He wrote, he actually acted in a film as well, which, you know, is the first as far as we know it. And just the amazing strength that you get from that, both mentally, but then also being able to continue to provide for your family. And that's something we were always very conscious of as a family, is that other people living with this level of disability often don't have those opportunities.
Steve, can you amplify on this, the therapy that seems to be helping people who've been paralyzed regain some of the function they've lost is activity, isn't it?
Yes, activity-based therapies are very important. And Alexandra was commenting on some of the health issues that people with spinal cord injury have. They lose lots of bone mineral density and have osteoporosis at earlier ages. They develop skin breakdown with pressure ulcers. They have glucose intolerance. They develop cardiovascular disease at an early level. And as physicians, we've always known that these were the complications of paralysis. We have begun to recently understand the importance of activity-based therapies, and the Reeve Foundation has started something that a project called the Neuro Recovery Network, which is really an activity-based therapy.
When did doctors begin to suspect that the spinal cord was wired with a backup program for walking, even if the connection to the brain has been severed or compromised?
In the last 7 years or so, I believe that we have really started to think of the spinal cord as having memory, very much like the brain. And we believe that stepping or walking is a reflex. And so the Neuro Recovery Network, which is a project that is a multi-center trial sponsored by the Reeve Foundation in a cooperative agreement with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is a project where patients are placed in a treadmill, a body weight supported treadmill, and their legs are patterned toward walking. And these are people who have incomplete injuries, and we can already see that people really do grasp how to walk again rapidly.
So does this locomotor training teach the spinal cord to take over functions the brain had performed previously?
I think that it reminds the spinal cord how to perform the function. And I think that that memory is there in the cord.
Is this something that's widely accepted by the medical community?
It is. You know, it is interesting. It is widely accepted by the medical community, but as Alexander was saying, it's an expensive therapy to provide. Actually, the studies that were originally done were done in Europe in the late 90s by Dieter, and they showed that people who had activity-based therapies with spinal cord injury could have functional improvement.
So why is there resistance? Is it simply because it costs a lot of money?
I think it's an upfront investment. To provide a locomotor training for a 12-week period is probably about $80,000. And I think that insurance companies in many ways say that's a lot of money, but to heal a pressure ulcer is $130,000.
Well, we have this other side, which is if you can get somebody to function at least partially, then they're going to cost less money down the line. Isn't this a penny-wise, pound-foolish approach?
Absolutely, and I would agree with that.
I think it's something that we see time and time again. Particularly dealing with insurance companies. As Steve was saying, a pressure ulcer can cost up to $130,000. Cushions that help relieve those pressure sores cost $400. Oftentimes those aren't covered. And so you just see this approach focusing on short-term, forgetting to focus on short-term expenses, and in the end it ends up costing a lot more in the long term.
Doctors used to believe that patients could only expect to improve for 2 years following a spinal cord injury. Have you seen substantial progress in patients who've been injured for longer than 2 years?
I have. I actually have several patients who have participated in the Neuro Recovery Network. I have a patient who works for Medicare, which is wonderful, as a case manager, who is spinal cord injured. And he has been in his chair 20 years. He participated in the Neuro Recovery Network, and he is now walking about 300 feet with a rolling walker in his house, which gives him great independence. And so 18 years later, we're seeing improvement.
And you put some of the videos on your website, haven't you?
We have. It's amazing to see the stories. And I think one of the important things is to realize we often get caught up and talk about a cure for spinal cord injury. Really, the language should be many cures, because having increased bladder control, that's a cure. Having increased sensation, that's a cure. My father, about 7 years into his injury, he participated in the Neuro Recovery Network in doing this treadmill walking therapy. And as we were saying before, he did a whole number of physical therapies that helped him. But he began to get increased sensation and could suddenly feel touch on his legs. And through the Neuro Recovery Network, was able to take some steps, you know, in the harness, and also participate in another program in a pool where he was actually able to push off with his feet. Obviously, it's limited recovery. He was still remained in his chair and was dependent on the ventilator. But just these small steps, these small forms of progress made a world of difference to him.
And I would also say that the sensation is a significant recovery, because one of the greatest risks for people is the development of a pressure ulcer or a bed sore. And if they have improvement in sensation, it can help them to tell their caregivers to help reposition them if they're unable to reposition themselves, and help prevent these secondary complications.
A listener named Vicky wrote in that she remembers news reports of a medical researcher in the late 60s or early 70s who was making it possible for paraplegics to move their legs by hooking their muscles up to electrodes controlled by computers. She was working as an early computer programmer, so this was something she found interesting. Is that being done? Because we've seen all sorts of reports about people returning from Iraq who've lost limbs, who are able to walk because of this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Is it happening with spinal cord injuries?
It is. Electrical stimulation or functional electrical stimulation is commonly used now, and we use it when we identify muscles that are moving. We place the electrical stimulation on the muscles and cause contraction of the muscles, which cause them to gain strength, and then we try to translate that strength into function.
Uh-huh.
I actually was reading yesterday about a phenomenal program that someone has started in Boston, and there are three guys who row on the Charles River every day using this electrical stimulation to help push their legs, and that's great freedom. Talk about getting out of a wheelchair and doing something different.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, in those videos that you have at ChristopherReeve.org, all of the videos are of males. Is that just an accident? The thought would be that only men suffer from spinal cord injuries, and I know for a fact that's not true.
That's exactly right. That's an accident. I know myself four women who have participated in ones just in our area, so that's not a correct statement. What is interesting, though, is another area. The Reeve Foundation published a study earlier this year that talked about the prevalence of spinal cord injuries and paralysis in the country. And it is true that the numbers are disproportionately skewed to gender, 60% male, 40% women.
I want to return to that after we take a little break. My guests are here to talk about spinal cord injuries and the latest research and some promising new approaches, Alexandra Reeve Givens and also Dr. Steve Williams. Stay with us for more. We're back with Dr. Steve Williams, the chairman of the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at Boston University's School of Medicine, director of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Neuro Recovery Network at the Boston Medical Center, and with Alexandra Reeve Givens, who's a member of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Board of Directors, and is an attorney. And does that apply in any way? Can you use those skills in dealing with these issues?
It does. People might be able to tell from my voice I'm a young attorney. And it's nice being able to see the balance, to have the role both having responsibility running this organization as well as advocacy on the side.
We got a message from a doctor in Boston, by the way. He left this question on our show page. I am a physician who is board certified in SCI medicine and also spinal cord injured myself. I have found it extremely difficult to find employment despite my education, training, and experience. Do you feel that this field and patients with SCI would benefit from having more doctors like myself? And if so, what is being done to encourage such inclusion?
I agree. I believe that there are many barriers to employment for people with severe disabilities. And some of those include accessibility to workplace. Some include the ability of an employer to be adaptable in time frames that people work, et cetera. I do think that physicians in particular, there are many physicians I actually know who are spinal cord injured, who work in the spinal cord injury field, and I believe that they are very encouraging, and I think that their presence empowers people who have recently become spinal cord injured to realize that although their lives are different after spinal cord injury, they can still be full and joyful.
Well, you'd imagine that some medical institution would see this doctor as a positive rather than as a problem.
I would hope they would.
I think that question really does highlight a serious issue for people in the disability community. We referenced earlier a survey that the Reeve Foundation released earlier this year, which was the largest population-based study of people living with paralysis as well as with spinal cord injury in particular. And one of the most striking findings for me was that 60% of the population living with paralysis have a household income below $25,000 a year. So it's a lot of people who, in addition to dealing with huge medical bills, are also just, you know, struggling to get by, and I think employment's a major cause of that.
Are spinal cord injuries the most common cause of paralysis?
Actually,
I'll let the doctor answer that one.
Actually, I sat on that National Paralysis Task Force, which was organized by the Reef Foundation. And as we did this population survey, we really tried to define the number of people in America who were paralyzed.
And you turned out a lot more than you thought.
We did. There are 5.6 million people living in the United States with paralysis. And previously, it had been estimated to be at most 4 million. And interestingly, the greatest number that had been thought to have spinal cord injury had been 255,000, and we found that there were almost 1.3 million.
But stroke is the most common cause of paralysis.
You're correct. It is stroke followed by spinal cord injury.
And then multiple sclerosis.
Yes.
Now, why were the estimates so low in the past?
I think that many patients are not counted. I think that they are initially injured and they are followed by their primary care physician and do not seek out care with rehabilitation specialist or neurologist.
They're just written off. You know, this is the way it is and you just give in?
Potentially, but also I think it's geographical. I think that around the country that lots of Americans live in small towns where there isn't access to care at this level. And so patients in major medical centers who have access to spinal cord injury physicians or a world-class neurologist are often included in studies and population studies that help to identify them.
Had you suspected that many cases of paralysis were going underreported?
Yes, and I think that was one of the reasons that we came together really to form this task force was really to identify the extent of the of paralysis so that we would have a greater understanding so that we could advocate for greater resources to be dedicated to research and quality of life.
Now, Alexandra, the study also revealed that a disproportionately high number of African Americans and Native Americans are living with paralysis. Do we know why? Is it for the same reasons that they also suffer disproportionately from other illnesses like heart disease?
Those numbers are truly astonishing. Just to give a little bit more detail, the Native American population is, when you look at the general population, is 0.8%. When you look at the spinal cord injury population, it's 7%.
Wow.
So it's a significant overrepresentation.
So it's under 1% to 7%.
To 7%. And then in the African-American population, you go from them being 12% of the general population to being 15% of the population living with spinal cord injury. We still have a lot of work to do to figure out exactly why that's happening. But it's one of the goals of the Reef Foundation, and we actually have outreach programs. For example, with the Navajo Nation is one group that we've been working with to begin to implement some healthcare protocols, and also just to reach out and help to improve the quality of life. When you talked before about employment being difficult for people living with disabilities, accessibility, those numbers are often magnified tenfold, a hundredfold when you look at the reservations. And so that's something that we're certainly focused on.
Well, the study also found that households with lower incomes tend to have a higher rate of people living with paralysis.
I think it's very interesting because I think that as well, one of the issues may be education at earlier ages. And I think that spinal cord injury prevention programs that occur in many schools in the U.S. may not be occurring on the reservations the way they do in other school systems and possibly in inner city schools as well. Children may not be hearing about wearing their seatbelt, crossing the street appropriately, falling from a ladder, not standing on chairs, bouncing on beds, et cetera. So I think that a lot of it is education as well.
The locomotor training that we've been talking about is intensive. Each session requires four therapists and some specialized equipment. How many rehabilitation centers currently offer it?
We currently have 9 in the Reef Foundation network that are offering the treadmill walking therapy. But as you said, it's very expensive. Fortunately, insurance companies are paying for it in many cases, but with this caveat that most treat it the same as physical therapy for a sprained ankle. Most policies out there will give you 30 rehabilitation sessions if you sprain your ankle or if you smash your spinal cord, with no differentiation between the two. And that's something that I think significantly needs to change for this program to work, for people to get the benefits of the therapy. They obviously need far more than that.
And do we know, have any idea how long? I'm sure it's different for each person, but how long is each locomotor training session, and how long would a patient need to participate before any appreciable results might be seen?
Well, it varies significantly depending on the needs of the patient, and that's something that we're really working on now and developing as a network, is a comprehensive study of exactly how this should be administered, who is most likely to benefit from the treatments, what exactly the schedule should be, and what level of acute injury, how soon after an injury the treatment should be administered.
I'd imagine there's a psychological factor here, because people can work really hard and hope and assume that if they do everything they're supposed to do, that they're going to see improvement, and sometimes they won't, or at least for a time.
My experience with locomotor training has been patients do have varying levels of improvement in function, but I do think that participating in therapy has many benefits, as Alexandra was saying earlier with her father, even improvement in sensation. I've had patients who have participated and have regained the ability to walk, and I've had patients who have not gained the ability to walk but have gained the ability to turn in bed and reposition themselves. They feel they sit better, so they don't have back pain. They are more able to control their bladder and their bowels. So there can be many aspects of this adaptive training that can have an impact on a person's life other than simply walking.
My guests are Dr. Steve Williams and Alexandra Reeve Givens. We're talking about spinal cord injuries and the latest techniques for helping people rehabilitate. And there's no cure, right? I mean, at best, we're talking about people who can function better than they did before.
As of right now, there's no cure, but we're hopeful for the future.
In March, President Obama signed the Christopher and Dana Reeve Paralysis Act into law. Can you tell us about that and what it entails?
Sure. It was. It's an act that we've been in, that's been in development for a significant period of time, and it's funny, we often analogize it to a license to hunt, because it gives us permission to come back to the federal government and ask for more funding to focus on numerous things, one of which is research into spinal cord injury, and the second is developing networks for researchers to be able to talk to one another. And that's something that, you know, we in the ordinary world, you don't think about as being a huge hurdle, but often people do get siloed. And the goal of this is to establish a consortium for people to begin communicating and speaking with one another.
Well, considering the numbers that you cited earlier, so many people dealing with paralysis, you'd think that a law like this would have been passed sometime in years ago. Has there been resistance in Congress or in the White House?
Well, this is part of what Stephen was saying, is that we just didn't know the numbers were so big before. Up until last year.
So the study really helped?
Up until last year, people thought that there were maybe 250,000 people in this country with spinal cord injury. The number's 1,250,000. It's a game changer. And so I think that's helped to push things forward in the national agenda. In addition, when we look at those survey results and see what large percentage of people living with paralysis are just struggling to make it by financially, when you see that medical bills are one of the leading causes of bankruptcy, hopefully I feel there's a changing impression in this country, realizing that when the numbers are that big and the problems are that severe, it's really a national investment to focus on research and helping people to get increased recovery.
Doesn't Medicare kick in?
Medicare doesn't kick in for people with disability until after 2 years of injury, whereas someone who's 65 years old, it immediately kicks in. And this is one of the goals, I think, that the Paralysis Act will work toward as well.
Because we said earlier that it often does help if you start the treatments almost immediately after the paralysis occurs. And if you're waiting 2 years, you're already creating a major disadvantage, aren't you?
That is true. You know, it's very interesting. I saw a patient yesterday who was newly injured, and we had a family meeting with his wife. And his wife said he is limited to $3,000 of outpatient physical therapy, just like Alexandra was saying. And she said, you know, there's no difference between differentiation between him and someone with a sprained ankle. And what are we going to do until Medicare kicks in?
What about getting Medicare to pay for motorized wheelchairs? Hasn't that been a problem?
That has been a problem. A lot, and it's the same with private insurance companies as well. They won't finance a motorized wheelchair unless somebody can show that they need it in their home. Now, a home is often where people have the easiest accessibility. They can get around either with a walker or they've made adaptions to their house. Really, we want people to get out of the house. We want them to be able to get back to work, to go in for treatment. And so it's programs like that, it's, you know, policies like that that aren't really focusing on the needs of patients and what can help people. And really, when we think about programs that can help people get back into the workforce, that's all in our national, that's in the national interest in the long run.
One of the problems with stem cell research is that people expected miracles to occur and cures to happen right away. Is that a problem that you face in convincing people to continue to try to help?
It is. It's letting people know that we're in this for the long haul and that there's going to be no magic bullet. There's not one answer.
It's taken a lot longer for us to even understand what HIV/AIDS is all about than anybody predicted. Cancer, didn't Richard Nixon say we were going to beat it in 25 years?
Yeah.
That hasn't happened.
Right, and that's always the tough thing, is balancing the hope with the reality. At the moment, one of the most exciting things about stem cell research is the opportunities it provides for education. The fact that we can now see how motor neurons develop by watching them in a petri dish, that you would be able to test drugs, test therapies by working on motor neurons that have been grown from an embryonic stem cell. Those are really exciting technologies, and those are much closer, you know, seeing how a motor neuron connects to a muscle, for example. When you look at regeneration and then transplanting that into humans, that's further down the road, but it's exciting, and we just have to make sure that we're invested in what's going to be a long drive.
And I'd also like to say, as well as the Neuro Recovery Network that is funded by the Reeve Foundation, there's also the North American Clinical Trials Network, which has been started by the Reeve Foundation, and it's a group of 10 centers around the country with world experts in spinal cord injury, so that as new possible research projects arise, this center can immediately begin a multi-center study to bring advances to people who are suffering from spinal cord injury much more quickly.
I remember from college that I was taught that nerve cells can't really regenerate, that other cells can. Is that part of the problem you're facing here?
That is part of the problem. And, you know, we're only beginning to understand what is preventing them from regenerating. And I think that that is part of the stem cell problem as well. We know that stem cells have great potential, but how do we put these cells in and produce an environment that allows them to regenerate?
Are you hopeful that with the change of attitude in Washington that we're going to be seeing more progress sooner?
I believe that that is an important step forward, and I am very hopeful with the change in politics in Washington.
On the other hand, Alexandra, right now it's probably harder to get people to give you money because money is so much tighter than it's been in the past.
It's difficult, and we're a private foundation that's funded by private donations, and that's obviously very difficult in this economic climate. At the same time, we partner with the Department of Defense, with other governmental organizations. And as changes come to Washington, I think more people are realizing what we need to focus on is an investment, and that's healthcare, and it's investing in medical research to help get people out of chairs and getting improved recovery.
Well, you mentioned the Department of Defense. That's because people are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with spinal cord injuries?
That's exactly right. Our study showed that 67,000 people living with spinal cord injuries in this country are injured as a result of military service. When you look at numbers like that, that's a moral motivation to put more money into funding research and improving the quality of life.
And I also think that the research that we are speaking about towards spinal cord injury will benefit many people, people with ALS, people with MS. Mm-hmm. So I think that although we have really focused on spinal cord injury, which is a passion of ours and something that we would like to see people with spinal cord injury having better quality of life and better function, I think that our government and Americans need to see that this research has great impact for many people.
And the website is, again?
ChristopherReeve.org.
Are there any capitals there or just the name straight through?
Name straight through, all one word.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. Alexandra Reeve Givens is a member of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation's Board of Directors. She's an attorney. And Dr. Steve Williams. On tomorrow's show, we'll follow the path of gangs from Central America who migrated to Los Angeles and are now in Hempstead, Long Island. And then Academy Award-winning composer Elliot Goldenthal on writing the score for the new film Public Enemies. We'll take a look at the mystique surrounding John Dillinger. Plus, Word maven Patricia T. O'Connor answers your questions about grammar and the English language. The Leaded Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Sherry Shen, Alex Conrad, Natalie Pano, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.